And now part two of Speak Memory, written by Vladimir Nabokov, chapter 9. 1. I have before me a large bedraggled scrapbook bound in black cloth. It contains old documents, including diplomas, drafts, diaries, identity cards, penciled notes, and some printed matter which had been in my mother's meticulous keeping in Prague until her death there, but then, between 1939 and 1961, went through various vicissitudes. With the aid of those papers and my own recollections, I have composed the following short biography of my father. Vladimir Dmitrievich Nabokov, jurist, publicist, and statesman, son of Dmitri Nikolaevich Nabokov, Minister of Justice, and Baroness Maria von Korff, was born on July 20, 1870, at Tsarskoe Selo, near St. Petersburg, and was killed by an assassin's bullet on March 28, 1922, in Berlin. Till the age of 13, he was educated at home by French and English governesses and by Russian and German tutors. From one of the latter, he caught and passed on to me the Passio et Morbus Aureliani. In the autumn of 1883, he started to attend the gymnasium, corresponding to a combination of American high school and junior college, on the then Gagarin Street, presumably renamed in the 20s by the short-sighted Soviets. His desire to excel was overwhelming. One winter night, being behind with a set task and preferring pneumonia to ridicule at the blackboard, he exposed himself to the polar frost with the hope of a timely sickness by sitting in nothing but his nightshirt at the open window. It gave on the palace square and its moon-polished pillar. On the morrow he still enjoyed perfect health, and undeservedly it was the dreaded teacher who happened to be laid up. At 16, in May 1887, he completed the gymnasium course with a gold medal and studied law at the St. Petersburg University, graduating in January 1891. He continued his studies in Germany, mainly at Halle. 30 years later, a fellow student of his, with whom he had gone for a bicycle trip in the Black Forest, sent my widowed mother the Madame Bovary volume which my father had had with him at the time, and on the flyleaf of which he had written, "The Unsurpassed Pearl of French Literature," a judgment that still holds. On November 14th, a date scrupulously celebrated every subsequent year in our anniversary-conscious family, 1897, he married Elena Ivanovna Rukavishnikov, the 21-year-old daughter of a country neighbor with whom he had 6 children. The first was a stillborn boy. In 1895, he had been made junior gentleman of the chamber. From 1896 to 1904, he lectured on criminal law at the Imperial School of Jurisprudence, Pravovedenye, in St. Petersburg. Gentlemen of the chamber were supposed to ask permission of the court minister before performing a public act. This permission my father did not ask, naturally, when publishing in the Review Pravo his celebrated article, "The Bloodbath of Kishinev," in which he condemned the part played by the police in promoting the Kishinev pogrom of 1903. By imperial decree, he was deprived of his court title in January 1905, after which he severed all connection with the Tsar's government and resolutely plunged into anti-despotic politics, while continuing his juristic labors. From 1905 to 1915, he was president of the Russian section of the International Criminology Association, and at conferences in Holland amused himself and amazed his audience by orally translating, when needed, Russian and English speeches into German and French, and vice versa. He was eloquently against capital punishment. Unswervingly, he conformed to his principles in private and public matters. At an official banquet in 1904, he refused to drink the Tsar's health. He is said to have coolly advertised in the papers his court uniform for sale. From 1906 to 1917, he co-edited with I.V. Hessen and A.I. Kaminka one of the few liberal dailies in Russia, the Wretch Speech, as well as the jurisprudential review Pravo. Politically, he was a cadet, i.e., a member of the KD, Konstitutsiono Demokratichskaya Partia, later renamed more aptly the Party of the People's Freedom, Partia Narodnoy Svobody. With his keen sense of humor, he would have been tremendously tickled by the helpless, though vicious, hash Soviet lexicographers have made of his opinions and achievements in their rare biographical comments on him. In 1906 he was elected to the first Russian parliament, Pervaya Duma, a humane and heroic institution, predominantly liberal, but which ignorant foreign publicists, infected by Soviet propaganda, often confuse with the ancient Boyar Dumas. There he made several splendid speeches with nationwide repercussions. When less than a year later the Tsar dissolved the Duma, a number of members, including my father, who, as a photograph taken at the Finland station shows, carried his railway ticket tucked under the band of his hat, repaired to Vyborg for an illegal session. In May 1908, he began a prison term of 3 months in somewhat belated punishment for the revolutionary manifesto he and his group had issued at Vyborg. "Did V get any agarias, speckled woods, this summer?" he asks in one of his secret notes from prison, which, through a bribed guard and a faithful friend, Kaminka, were transmitted to my mother at Vera. "Tell him that all I see in the prison yard are brimstones and cabbage whites." After his release, he was forbidden to participate in public elections, but, one of the paradoxes so common under the Tsars, could freely work in the bitterly liberal Wretch, a task to which he devoted up to 9 hours a day. In 1913, he was fined by the government the token sum of 100 rubles, about as many dollars of the present time, for his reportage from Kiev, where after a stormy trial, Bayliss was found innocent of murdering a Christian boy for ritual purposes. Justice and public opinion could still prevail occasionally in old Russia. They had only 5 years to go. He was mobilized soon after the beginning of World War I and sent to the front. Eventually, he was attached to the general staff in St. Petersburg. Military ethics prevented him from taking an active part in the first turmoil of the liberal revolution of March 1917. From the very start, history seems to have been anxious of depriving him of a full opportunity to reveal his great gifts of statesmanship in a Russian republic of the Western type. In 1917, during the initial stage of the provisional government, that is, while the cadets still took part in it, he occupied in the Council of Ministers the responsible but inconspicuous position of Executive Secretary. In the winter of 1917-18, he was elected to the Constituent Assembly, only to be arrested by energetic Bolshevist sailors when it was disbanded. The November Revolution had already entered upon its gory course. Its police was already active. But in those days the chaos of orders and counter-orders sometimes took our side. My father followed a dim corridor, saw an open door at the end, walked out into a side street and made his way to the Crimea with a knapsack he had ordered his valet Osip to bring him to a secluded corner and a package of caviar sandwiches, which good Nikolai Andreevich, our cook, had added of his own accord. From mid-1918 to the beginning of 1919, in an interval between two occupations by the Bolshevists, and in constant friction with trigger-happy elements in Denikin's army, he was Minister of Justice, of minimal justice, as he used to say wryly, in one of the regional governments, the Crimean one. In 1919, he went into voluntary exile, living first in London, then in Berlin, where, in collaboration with Hessen, he edited the liberal émigré daily Rule, Rudder, until his assassination in 1922 by a sinister ruffian, whom during World War II Hitler made administrator of émigré Russian affairs. He wrote prolifically, mainly on political and criminological subjects. He knew à fond the prose and poetry of several countries, knew by heart hundreds of verses. His favorite Russian poets were Pushkin, Tyutchev, and Fet. He published a fine essay on the latter, was an authority on Dickens, and besides Flaubert, prized highly Stendhal, Balzac, and Zola, three detestable mediocrities from my point of view. He used to confess that the creation of a story or poem, any story or poem, was to him as incomprehensible a miracle as the construction of an electric machine. On the other hand, he had no trouble at all in writing on juristic and political matters. He had a correct, albeit rather monotonous style, which today, despite all those old-world metaphors of classical education and grandiloquent clichés of Russian journalism, has, at least to my jaded ear, an attractive gray dignity of its own, an extraordinary contrast, as if belonging to some older and poorer relative, to his colorful, quaint, often poetical, and sometimes ribald, everyday utterances. The preserved drafts of some of his proclamations, beginning «граждане» and meaning «citoyen», and editorials, are penned in a copybook slanted, beautifully sleek, unbelievably regular hand, almost free of corrections, a purity, a certainty, a mind and matter co-function that I find amusing to compare to my own mousy hand and messy drafts, to the massacrous revisions and rewritings and new revisions of the very lines in which I am taking 2 hours now to describe a 2-minute run of his flawless handwriting. His drafts were the fair copies of immediate thought. In this manner he wrote, with phenomenal ease and rapidity, sitting uncomfortably at a child's desk in the classroom of a mournful palace, the text of the abdication of Grand Duke Mikhail, next in line of succession after the Tsar had renounced his and his son's throne. No wonder he was also an admirable speaker, an English-style, cool orator, who eschewed the meat-chopping gesture and rhetorical bark of the demagogue. And here, too, the ridiculous cacologist I am, when not having a typed sheet before me, has inherited nothing. Only recently have I read for the first time his important Zbornik Stiate po Ugolovnomu Pravu, a collection of articles on criminal law published in 1904 in St. Petersburg, of which a very rare, possibly unique copy, formerly the property of a Mikhail Egrafovich Hodunov, as stamped in violet ink on the flyleaf, was given me by a kind traveler, Andrew Field, who bought it in a second-hand bookshop on his visit to Russia in 1961. It is a volume of 316 pages containing 19 papers. In one of these carnal crimes written in 1902, my father discusses, rather prophetically in a certain odd sense, cases in London of little girls à l'âge le plus tendre, в нежнейшем возрасте, i.e. from 8 to 12 years, being sacrificed to lechers, сластолюбцам. In the same essay, he reveals a very liberal and modern approach to various abnormal practices, incidentally coining a convenient Russian word for homosexual, равнополье. It would be impossible to list the literally thousands of his articles in various periodicals, such as Wretch or Pravo. In a later chapter, I speak of his historically interesting book about a wartime semi-official visit to England, some of his memoirs pertaining to the years 1917 to 1919 have appeared in the Arkiv Ruskoy Revolyutsii, published by Hessen in Berlin. On January 16, 1920, he delivered a lecture at King's College London on Soviet rule and Russia's future, which was published a week later in the supplement to the New Commonwealth, number 15, neatly pasted in my mother's album. In the spring of the same year, I learned by heart most of it when preparing to speak against Bolshevism at a union debate in Cambridge. The victorious apologist was a man from the Manchester Guardian. I forget his name, but recall drying up utterly after reciting what I had memorized, and that was my first and last political speech. A couple of months before my father's death, the émigré review «Théâtre et жизнь», «Theatre and Life», started to serialize his boyhood recollections. He and I are overlapping now, too briefly. I find therein excellently described the terrible tantrums of his pedantic master of Latin at the Third Gymnasium, as well as my father's very early and lifelong passion for the opera. He must have heard practically every first-rate European singer between 1880 and 1922, and although unable to play anything, except very majestically the first chords of the Ruslan Overture, remembered every note of his favorite operas. Along this vibrant string, a melodious gene that missed me glides through my father from the 16th-century organist Wolfgang Graun to my son. 2. I was 11 years old when my father decided that the tutoring I had had and was still having at home might be profitably supplemented by my attending Tienyshev School. This school, one of the most remarkable in St. Petersburg, was a comparatively young institution of a much more modern and liberal type than the ordinary gymnasium to which general category it belonged. Its course of study, consisting of 16 semesters, 8 gymnasium classes, would be roughly equivalent in America to the last 6 years of school plus the first 2 of college. Upon my admittance in January 1911, I found myself in the 3rd semester, or in the beginning of the 8th grade, according to the American system. School was taught from the 15th of September to the 25th of May, with a couple of interruptions, a 2-week intersemestral gap to make place, as it were, for the huge Christmas tree that touched with its star the pale green ceiling of our prettiest drawing room, and a 1-week Easter vacation, during which painted eggs enlivened the breakfast table. Since snow and frost lasted from October well into April, no wonder the mean of my school memories is definitely Heimel. When Ivan I, who vanished one day, or Ivan II, who was to see the time when I would send him forth on romantic errands, came to wake me around 8 a.m., the outside world was still cowled in brown Hyperborean gloom. The electric light in the bedroom had a sullen, harsh, jaundiced tinge that made my eyes smart. Leaning my singing ear on my hand and propping my elbow on the pillow, I would force myself to prepare 10 pages of unfinished homework. On my bed table, next to a stocky lamp with 2 bronze lion heads, stood a small unconventional clock, an upright container of crystal within which black-numbered ivory-white, page-like lamels flipped from right to left, each stopping for a minute the way commercial stills did on the old cinema screen. I gave myself 10 minutes to tintype the text in my brain, nowadays it would take me 2 hours, and say 12 minutes to tub, dress, with Ivan's help, scutter downstairs, and swallow a cup of tepid cocoa from the surface of which I plucked off by the center a round of wrinkled brown skin. Mornings were botched, and such things as the lessons in boxing and fencing that a wonderful rubbery Frenchman, Monsieur Lustalot, used to give me, had to be discontinued. He still came, almost daily, however, to spar or fence with my father. I would dash, with my fur coat half on, through the green drawing room, where an odor of fur, hot wax, and tangerines would linger long after Christmas had gone, toward the library, from which came a medley of stamping and scraping sounds. There I would find my father, a big, robust man, looking still bigger in his white training suit, thrusting and parrying, while his agile instructor added brisk exclamations, "Battez! Rompez!" to the click-clink of the foils. Panting a little, my father would remove the convex fencing mask from his perspiring pink face to kiss me good morning. The place combined pleasantly the scholarly and the athletic, the leather of books, and the leather of boxing gloves. Fat armchairs stood along the book-lined walls. An elaborate punching-ball affair purchased in England, 4 steel posts supporting the board from which the pear-shaped striking bag hung, gleamed at the end of the spacious room. The purpose of this apparatus, especially in connection with the machine-gun-like ratata of its bag, was questioned, and the butler's explanation of it reluctantly accepted as true by some heavily armed street fighters who came in through the window in 1917. When the Soviet Revolution made it imperative for us to leave St. Petersburg, that library disintegrated, but queer little remnants of it kept cropping up abroad. Some 12 years later, in Berlin, I picked up from a bookstall one such waif, bearing my father's Ex Libris. Very fittingly, it turned out to be The War of the Worlds by Wells. And after another decade had elapsed, I discovered one day in the New York Public Library, indexed under my father's name, a copy of the neat catalog he had had privately printed when the phantom books listed therein still stood, ruddy and sleek, on his shelves. 3. He would replace his mask and go on with his stamping and lunging, while I hurried back the way I had come. After the warmth in the entrance hall, where logs were crackling in the large fireplace, the outdoor air gave an icy shock to one's lungs. I would ascertain which of our 2 cars, the Benz or the Wolseley, was there to take me to school. The first, a gray landaulette, manned by Volkov, a gentle, pale-faced chauffeur, was the older one. Its lines had seemed positively dynamic in comparison with those of the insipid, noseless, and noiseless electric coupe that had preceded it, but in its turn it acquired an old-fashioned top-heavy look, with a sadly shrunken bonnet, as soon as the comparatively long, black English limousine came to share its garage. To get the newer car was to start the day zestfully. Pirogov, the second chauffeur, was a very short, pudgy fellow, with a russet complexion that matched well the shade of the furs he wore over his corduroy suit and the orange-brown of his leggings. When some hitch in the traffic forced him to apply the brakes, which he did by suddenly distending himself in a peculiar, springy manner, or when I bothered him by trying to communicate with him through the squeaky and not very efficient speaking tube, the back of his thick neck seen through the glass partition would turn crimson. He frankly preferred to drive the hardy convertible Opel that we used in the country during 3 or 4 seasons, and would do so at 60 miles per hour, to realize how dashing that was in 1912, one should take into account the present inflation of speed. Indeed, the very essence of summer freedom, schoolless untownishness, remains connected in my mind with the motor's extravagant roar that the opened muffler would release on the long, lone highway. When, in the second year of World War I, Pirogov was mobilized, he was replaced by dark, wild-eyed Tsiganov, a former racing ace who had participated in various contests both in Russia and abroad, and had had several ribs broken in a bad smash in Belgium. Later, sometime in 1917, soon after my father resigned from Kerensky's cabinet, Tsiganov decided, notwithstanding my father's energetic protests, to save the powerful Wolseley car from possible confiscation by dismantling it and distributing its parts over hiding places known only to him. Still later, in the gloom of a tragic autumn, with the Bolshevists gaining the upper hand, one of Kerensky's aides asked my father for a sturdy car the Premier might use if forced to leave in a hurry. But our debile old Benz would not do, and the Wolseley had embarrassingly vanished. And if I treasure the recollection of that request, recently denied by my eminent friend but certainly made by his aide-de-camp, it is only from a compositional viewpoint, because of the amusing thematic echo of Christina von Korff's part in the Varenne episode of 1791. Although heavy snowfalls were much more usual in St. Petersburg than, say, around Boston, the several automobiles that circulated among the numerous sleighs of the town before World War I somehow never seemed to get into the kind of hideous trouble that modern cars get into on a good New England white Christmas. Many strange forces had been involved in the building of the city. One is led to suppose that the arrangement of its snows, tidy drifts along the sidewalks, and a smooth, solid spread on the octangular wood blocks of the pavement was arrived at by some unholy cooperation between the geometry of the streets and the physics of the snow clouds. Anyway, driving to school never took more than a quarter of an hour. Our house was number 47 in Morskaya Street. Then came Prince Oginski's, number 45, then the Italian Embassy, number 43, then the German Embassy, number 41, and then the vast Maria Square, after which the house numbers continued to dwindle. There was a small public park on the north side of the square. In one of its linden trees, an ear and a finger had been found one day, remnants of a terrorist whose hand had slipped while he was arranging a lethal parcel in his room on the other side of the square. Those same trees, a pattern of silver filigree and a mother-of-pearl mist out of which the bronze dome of St. Isaac's arose in the background, had also seen children shot down at random from the branches into which they had climbed in a vain attempt to escape the mounted gendarmes who were quelling the First Revolution, 1905-6. Quite a few little stories like these were attached to squares and streets in St. Petersburg. Upon reaching Nevsky Avenue, one followed it for a long stretch, during which it was a pleasure to overtake with no effort some cloaked guardsman in his light sleigh drawn by a pair of black stallions, snorting and speeding along under the bright blue netting that prevented lumps of hard snow from flying into the passenger's face. A street on the left side with a lovely name, Karavannaya, the street of caravans, took one past an unforgettable toy shop. Next came the Chinizelli Circus, famous for its wrestling tournaments. Finally, after crossing an ice-bound canal, one drove up to the gates of Tienyshev School in Mohovaya Street, the Street of Mosses. 4. Belonging, as he did by choice, to the great classless intelligentsia of Russia, my father thought it right to have me attend a school that was distinguished by its democratic principles, its policy of non-discrimination in matters of rank, race, and creed, and its up-to-date educational methods. Apart from that, Tienyshev School differed in nothing from any other school in time or space. As in all schools, the boys tolerated some teachers and loathed others. And, as in all schools, there was a constant interchange of obscene quips and erotic information. Being good at games, I would not have found the whole business too dismal if only my teachers had been less intent in trying to save my soul. They accused me of not conforming to my surroundings, of showing off, mainly by peppering my Russian papers with English and French terms which came naturally to me, or refusing to touch the filthy wet towels in the washroom, of fighting with my knuckles instead of using the slap-like swing with the underside of the fist adopted by Russian scrappers. The headmaster, who knew little about games, though greatly approving of their consociative virtues, was suspicious of my always keeping goal in soccer instead of running about with the other players. Another thing that provoked resentment was my driving to and from school in an automobile, and not traveling by streetcar or horse cab as the other boys, good little Democrats, did. With his face all screwed up in a grimace of disgust, one teacher suggested to me that the least I could do was to have the automobile stop 2 or 3 blocks away so that my schoolmates might be spared the sight of a liveried chauffeur doffing his cap. It was as if the school were allowing me to carry about a dead rat by the tail with the understanding that I would not dangle it under people's noses. The worst situation, however, arose from the fact that even then I was intensely averse to joining movements or associations of any kind. I enraged the kindest and most well-meaning among my teachers by declining to participate in extracurricular group work, debating societies with the solemn election of officers and the reading of reports on historical questions, and in the higher grades, more ambitious gatherings for the discussion of current political events. The constant pressure upon me to belong to some group or other never broke my resistance, but led to a state of tension that was hardly alleviated by everybody harping upon the example set by my father. My father was, indeed, a very active man, but as so often happens with the children of famous fathers, I viewed his activities through a prism of my own, which split into many enchanting colors the rather austere light my teachers glimpsed. In connection with his varied interests, criminological, legislative, political, editorial, philanthropic, he had to attend many committee meetings, and these were often held at our house. That such a meeting was forthcoming might be always deduced from a peculiar sound in the far end of our large and resonant entrance hall. There, in a recess under the marble staircase, our Schweitzer, Dormann, would be busy sharpening pencils when I came home from school. For that purpose, he used a bulky, old-fashioned machine with a whirring wheel, the handle of which he rapidly turned with one hand, while holding with the other a pencil inserted into a lateral orifice. For years he had been the tritest type of faithful retainer imaginable, full of quaint wit and wisdom, with a dashing way of smoothing out, right and left, his mustache with 2 fingers, and a slight fried fish smell always hanging about him. It originated in his mysterious basement quarters, where he had an obese wife and twins, a schoolboy of my age, and a haunting, sloppy little Aurora with a blue squint and coppery locks. But that pencil chore must have considerably embittered poor old Ustin, for I can readily sympathize with him. I, who write my stuff only in very sharp pencil, keep bouquets of B3s in vaselets around me, and rotate 100 times a day the handle of the instrument clamped to the table edge, which so speedily accumulates so much tawny brown shag in its little drawer. It later turned out that he had long got into touch with the Tsar's secret police, Tyros, of course, in comparison to Dzerzhinsky's or Yagoda's men, but still fairly bothersome. As early as 1906, for instance, the police, suspecting my father of conducting clandestine meetings at Vera, had engaged the services of Ustin, who thereupon begged my father under some pretext that I cannot recall, but with the deep purpose of spying on whatever went on, to take him to the country that summer as an extra footman. He had been pantry boy in the Rukavishnikov household. And it was he, omnipresent Ustin, who in the winter of 1917-18 heroically led representatives of the victorious Soviets up to my father's study on the second floor, and from there, through a music room and my mother's boudoir, to the southeast corner room where I was born, and to the niche in the wall, to the tiaras of colored fire, which formed an adequate recompense for the swallowtail he had once caught for me. Around 8 in the evening, the hall would house an accumulation of greatcoats and overshoes. In a committee room next to the library, at a long baize-covered table, where those beautifully pointed pencils had been laid out, my father and his colleagues would gather to discuss some phase of their opposition to the Tsar. Above the hubbub of voices, a tall clock in a dark corner would break into Westminster chimes, and beyond the committee room were mysterious depths, storerooms, a winding staircase, a pantry of sorts, where my cousin Yuri and I used to pause with drawn pistols on our way to Texas, and where one night the police placed a fat, blear-eyed spy, who went laboriously down on his knees before our librarian, Lyudmila Borisovna Greenberg, when discovered. But how on earth could I discuss all this with schoolteachers? 5. The reactionary press never ceased to attack my father's party, and I had got quite used to the more or less vulgar cartoons which appeared from time to time, my father and Milyukov handing over Saint Russia on a plate to world jewry and that sort of thing. But one day, in the winter of 1911, I believe, the most powerful of the rightist newspapers employed a shady journalist to concoct a scurrilous piece containing insinuations that my father could not let pass. Since the well-known rascality of the actual author of the article made him non-duelable, ne dueles posobni, as the Russian dueling code had it, my father called out the somewhat less disreputable editor of the paper in which the article had appeared. A Russian duel was a much more serious affair than the conventional Parisian variety. It took the editor several days to make up his mind whether or not to accept the challenge. On the last of these days, a Monday, I went as usual to school. In consequence of my not reading the newspapers, I was absolutely ignorant of the whole thing. Sometime during the day, I became aware that a magazine opened at a certain page was passing from hand to hand and causing titters. A well-timed swoop put me in possession of what proved to be the latest copy of a cheap weekly containing a lurid account of my father's challenge, with idiotic comments on the choice of weapons he had offered his foe. Sly digs were taken at his having reverted to a feudal custom that he had criticized in his own writings. There was also a good deal about the number of his servants and the number of his suits. I found out that he had chosen for his second his brother-in-law, Admiral Kolomeitsev, a hero of the Japanese War. During the Battle of Tsushima, this uncle of mine, then holding the rank of captain, had managed to bring his destroyer alongside the burning flagship and save the naval commander-in-chief. After classes, I ascertained that the magazine belonged to one of my best friends. I charged him with betrayal and mockery. In the ensuing fight, he crashed backwards into a desk, catching his foot in a joint and breaking his ankle. He was laid up for a month, but gallantly concealed from his family and from our teachers my share in the matter. The pang of seeing him carried downstairs was lost in my general misery. For some reason or other, no car came to fetch me that day, and during the cold, dreary, incredibly slow drive home in a hired sleigh, I had ample time to think matters over. Now I understood why the day before my mother had been so little with me and had not come down to dinner. I also understood what special coaching Ternan, a still finer maître d'armes than Lustalot, had of late been giving my father. What would his adversary choose, I kept asking myself, the blade or the bullet? Or had the choice already been made? Carefully, I took the beloved, the familiar, the richly alive image of my father at fencing, and tried to transfer that image, minus the mask and the padding, to the dueling ground in some barn or riding school. I visualized him and his adversary, both bare-chested, black-trousered, in furious battle, their energetic movements marked by that strange awkwardness which even the most elegant swordsman cannot avoid in a real encounter. The picture was so repulsive. So vividly did I feel the ripeness and nakedness of a madly pulsating heart about to be pierced, that I found myself hoping for what seemed momentarily a more abstract weapon. But soon I was in even deeper distress. As the sleigh crept along Nevsky Avenue, where blurry lights swam in the gathering dusk, I thought of the heavy black Browning my father kept in the upper right-hand drawer of his desk. I knew that pistol as well as I knew all the other more salient things in his study, the objet d'art of crystal or veined stone fashionable in those days, the glinting family photographs, the huge, mellowly illumined Perugino, the small honey-bright Dutch oils, and right over the desk, the rose and haze pastel portrait of my mother by Bakst. The artist had drawn her face in three-quarter view, wonderfully bringing out its delicate features, the upward sweep of the ash-colored hair it had grayed when she was in her 20s, the pure curve of the forehead, the dove-blue eyes, the graceful line of the neck. When I urged the old ragdoll-like driver to go faster, he would merely lean to one side with a special half-circular movement of his arm so as to make his horse believe he was about to produce the short whip he kept in the leg of his right felt boot, and that would be sufficient for the shaggy little hack to make as vague a show of speeding up as the driver had made of getting out his knutishko. In the almost hallucinatory state that our snow-muffled ride engendered, I refought all the famous duels a Russian boy knew so well. I saw Pushkin, mortally wounded at the first fire, grimly sit up to discharge his pistol at Dante. I saw Lermontov smile as he faced Martinov. I saw stout Sobinov in the part of Lenski crash down and send his weapon flying into the orchestra. No Russian writer of any repute had failed to describe une rencontre, a hostile meeting, always, of course, of the classical duel à volonté type, not the ludicrous back-to-back march-face-about-bang-bang performance of movie and cartoon fame. Among several prominent families, there had been tragic deaths on the dueling ground in more or less recent years. Slowly, my dreamy sleigh drove up Morskaya Street, and slowly dim silhouettes of duelists advanced upon each other and leveled their pistols and fired at the crack of dawn, in damp glades of old country estates, on bleak military training grounds, or in the driving snow between two rows of fir trees. And behind it all, there was yet a very special emotional abyss that I was desperately trying to skirt, lest I burst into a tempest of tears, and this was the tender friendship underlying my respect for my father. The charm of our perfect accord. The Wimbledon matches we followed in the London papers, the chess problems we solved, the Pushkin iambics that rolled off his tongue so triumphantly whenever I mentioned some minor poet of the day. Our relationship was marked by that habitual exchange of homespun nonsense, comically garbled words, proposed imitations of supposed intonations, and all those private jokes which are the secret code of happy families. With all that, he was extremely strict in matters of conduct, and given to biting remarks when cross with a child or a servant. But his inherent humanity was too great to allow his rebuke to Osip for laying out the wrong shirt to be really offensive, just as a first-hand knowledge of a boy's pride tempered the harshness of reproval and resulted in sudden forgiveness. Thus, I was more puzzled than pleased one day when, upon learning that I had deliberately slashed my leg just above the knee with a razor, I still bear the scar, in order to avoid a recitation in class for which I was unprepared, he seemed unable to work up any real wrath, and his subsequent admission of a parallel transgression in his own boyhood rewarded me for not withholding the truth. I remembered that summer afternoon, which already then seemed long ago, although actually only 4 or 5 years had passed, when he had burst into my room, grabbed my net, shot down the veranda steps, and presently was strolling back, holding between finger and thumb the rare and magnificent female of the Russian poplar admirable that he had seen basking on an aspen leaf from the balcony of his study. I remembered our long bicycle rides along the smooth Luga Highway, and the efficient way in which, mighty-calved, knickerbockered, tweed-coated, checker-capped, he would accomplish the mounting of his high-saddled dux, which his valet would bring up to the porch as if it were a palfrey. Surveying the state of its polish, my father would pull on his suede gloves and test under Ossip's anxious eye whether the tires were sufficiently tight. Then he would grip the handlebars, place his left foot on a metallic peg jutting at the rear end of the frame, push off with his right foot on the other side of the hind wheel, and after three or four such propellments, with the bicycle now set in motion, leisurely translate his right leg into pedal position, move up his left, and settle down on the saddle. At last I was home. And immediately upon entering the vestibule, I became aware of loud, cheerful voices. With the opportuneness of dream arrangements, my uncle the Admiral was coming downstairs. From the red-carpeted landing above, where an armless Greek woman of marble presided over a malachite bowl for visiting cards, my parents were still speaking to him, and as he came down the steps, he looked up with a laugh and slapped the balustrade with the gloves he had in his hand. I knew at once that there would be no duel, that the challenge had been met by an apology, that all was right. I brushed past my uncle and reached the landing. I saw my mother's serene, everyday face, but I could not look at my father. And then it happened. My heart welled in me like that wave on which the Buinya rose when her captain brought her alongside the burning Suvorov. And I had no handkerchief, and 10 years were to pass before a certain night in 1922 at a public lecture in Berlin, when my father shielded the lecturer, his old friend Milyukov, from the bullets of two Russian fascists, and while vigorously knocking down one of the assassins, was fatally shot by the other. But no shadow was cast by that future event upon the bright stairs of our St. Petersburg house. The large, cool hand resting on my head did not quaver, and several lines of play in a difficult chess composition were not blended yet on the board. Chapter 10 1. The Wild West fiction of Captain Mayne Reid, 1818-1883, translated and simplified, was tremendously popular with Russian children at the beginning of this century, long after his American fame had faded. Knowing English, I could savor his Headless Horseman in the unabridged original. Two friends swap clothes, hats, mounts, and the wrong man gets murdered. This is the main whorl of its intricate plot. The edition I had, possibly a British one, remains in the stacks of my memory as a puffy book bound in red cloth with a watery gray frontispiece, the gloss of which had been gauzed over when the book was new by a leaf of tissue paper. I see this leaf as it disintegrated, at first folded improperly, then torn off, but the frontispiece itself, which no doubt depicted Louise Poindexter's unfortunate brother, and perhaps a coyote or two, unless I am thinking of The Death Shot, another Mayne Reid tale, has been so long exposed to the blaze of my imagination that it is now completely bleached, but miraculously replaced by the real thing, as I noted when translating this chapter into Russian in the spring of 1953. And namely, by the view from a ranch you and I rented that year, a cactus and yucca waste, whence came that morning the plaintive call of a quail, Gamble's quail, I believe, overwhelming me with a sense of undeserved attainments and rewards. We shall now meet my cousin Yuri, a thin, sallow-faced boy with a round-cropped head and luminous gray eyes, the son of divorced parents, with no tutor to look after him, a town boy with no country home, he was in many respects different from me. He spent his winters in Warsaw with his father, Baron Yevgeny Rausch von Traubenberg, its military governor, and his summers at Batovo or Vira, unless taken abroad by his mother, my eccentric Aunt Nina, to dull Central European spas, where she went for long, solitary walks, leaving him to the care of messenger boys and chambermaids. In the country, Yuri got up late, and I did not see him before my return to lunch, after 4 or 5 hours of butterfly hunting. From his earliest boyhood, he was absolutely fearless, but was squeamish and wary of natural history, could not make himself touch wriggly things, could not endure the amusing, imprisoned tickle of a small frog groping about in one's fist like a person, or the discreet, pleasantly cool, rhythmically undulating caress of a caterpillar ascending one's bare shin. He collected little soldiers of painted lead. These meant nothing to me, but he knew their uniforms as well as I did different butterflies. He did not play any ball games, was incapable of pitching a stone properly, and could not swim, but had never told me he could not, and one day, as we were trying to cross the river by walking over a jam of pine logs afloat near a sawmill, he nearly got drowned when a particularly slippery bowl started to plop and revolve under his feet. We had first become aware of each other around Christmas 1904. I was 5 1/2, he 7, in Wiesbaden. I remember him coming out of a souvenir shop and running toward me with a breloque, an inch-long little pistol of silver, which he was anxious to show me, and suddenly sprawling on the sidewalk, but not crying when he picked himself up, unmindful of a bleeding knee and still clutching his minuscule weapon. In the summer of 1909 or 1910, he enthusiastically initiated me into the dramatic possibilities of the Main Reed books. He had read them in Russian, being in everything save surname much more Russian than I, and when looking for a playable plot was prone to combine them with Fenimore Cooper and his own fiery inventions. I viewed our games with greater detachment and tried to keep to the script. The staging took place generally in the park of Batovo, where the trails were even more tortuous and trappy than those of Vera. For our mutual manhunts, we used spring pistols that ejected, with considerable force, pencil-long sticks, from the brass tips of which we had manfully twisted off the protective rubber suction cups. Later came air guns of various types, which shot wax pellets or small tufted darts with non-lethal but often quite painful consequences. In 1912, the impressive mother-of-pearl plated revolver he arrived with was calmly taken away and locked up by my tutor Lenski, but not before we had blown to pieces a shoebox lid in prelude to the real thing, an ace, which we had been holding up by turns at a gentlemanly distance in a green avenue where a duel was rumored to have been fought many dim years ago. The following summer he was away in Switzerland with his mother, and soon after his death, in 1919, upon revisiting the same hotel and getting the same rooms they had occupied that July, she thrust her hand into the recesses of an armchair in quest of a fallen hairpin, and brought up a tiny cuirassier, unhorsed but with bandy legs still compressing an invisible charger. When he arrived for a week's visit in June 1914, now 16 1/2 to my 15, and the interval was beginning to tell, the first thing he did, as soon as we found ourselves alone in the garden, was to take out casually an ambered cigarette from a smart silver case, on the gilt inside of which he bade me observe the formula, 3 × 4 = 12, engraved in memory of the 3 nights he had spent at last with Countess G. He was now in love with an old general's young wife in Helsingfors, and a captain's daughter in Gatchina. I witnessed with a kind of despair every new revelation of his man-of-the-world style. "Where can I make some rather private calls?" he asked. So I led him past the 5 poplars and the old dry well, out of which we had been rope-hauled by 3 frightened gardeners only a couple of years before, to a passage in the servants' wing where the cooing of pigeons came from an inviting window-sill, and where there hung on the sun-stamped wall the remotest and oldest of our country-house telephones, a bulky, box-like contraption which had to be clangorously cranked up to educe a small-voiced operator. Yuri was now even more relaxed and sociable than the Mustanger of former years. Sitting on a deal table against the wall and dangling his long legs, he chatted with the servants, something I was not supposed to do and did not know how to do, with an aged footman with sideburns whom I had never seen grin before, or with a kitchen flirt, of whose bare neck and bold eyes I became aware only then. After Yuri had concluded his 3rd long-distance conversation, I noticed with a blend of relief and dismay how awful his French was, We walked down to the village grocery, which otherwise I never dreamed of visiting, let alone buying there a pound of black and white sunflower seeds. Throughout our return stroll, among the late afternoon butterflies that were preparing to roost, we munched and spat, he showing me how to perform it conveyor-wise, split the seed open between the right side back teeth, ease out the kernel with the tongue, spit out the husk halves, move the smooth kernel to the left side molars, and munch there, while the next seed, which in the meantime has already been cracked on the right, is being processed in its turn. Speaking of right, he admitted he was a staunch monarchist, of a romantic rather than political nature, and went on to deplore my alleged and perfectly abstract democratism. He recited samples of his fluent album poetry, and proudly remarked that he had been complimented by Dylan of Tomsky, a fashionable poet who favored Italian epigraphs and sectional titles, such as Songs of Lost Love, Nocturnal Urns, and so on, for the striking long rhyme Unemliu Musea, I hearken to the muse, and Liubvi Contusia, Love's Contusion, which I countered with my best and still unused find, Zapoved, Commandment, and Pozapivat, to sniffle. He was boiling with anger over Tolstoy's dismissal of the art of war, and burning with admiration for Prince Andrei Bolkonsky, for he had just discovered War and Peace, which I had read for the first time when I was 11, in Berlin on a Turkish sofa, in our somberly rococo Privatstrasse flat, giving on a dark, damp back garden with larches and gnomes that have remained in that book like an old postcard forever. I suddenly see myself in the uniform of an officer's training school. We are strolling again villageward in 1916, and, like Maurice Gerald and doomed Henry Poindexter, have exchanged clothes. Yuri is wearing my white flannels and striped tie. During the short week he stayed that year, we devised a singular entertainment which I have not seen described anywhere. There was a swing in the center of a small circular playground surrounded by jasmines at the bottom of our garden. We adjusted the ropes in such a way as to have the green swing board pass just a couple of inches above one's forehead and nose if one lay supine on the sand beneath. One of us would start the fun by standing on the board and swinging with increasing momentum. The other would lie down with the back of his head on a marked spot, and from what seemed an enormous height, the swinger's board would swish swiftly above the supine one's face. And 3 years later, as a cavalry officer in Denikin's army, he was killed fighting the Reds in northern Crimea. I saw him dead in Yalta, the whole front of his skull pushed back by the impact of several bullets, which had hit him like the iron board of a monstrous swing. When, having outstripped his detachment, he was in the act of recklessly attacking alone a Red machine gun nest. Thus was quenched his lifelong thirst for intrepid conduct in battle, for that ultimate gallant gallop with drawn pistol or unsheathed sword. Had I been competent to write his epitaph, I might have summed up matters by saying, in richer words than I can muster here, that all emotions, all thoughts, were governed in Yuri by one gift— a sense of honor equivalent morally to absolute pitch. 2. I have lately reread The Headless Horseman in a drab edition without pictures. It has its points. Take, for instance, that barroom in a log-walled Texan hotel in the year of our Lord, as the captain would say, 1850, with its shirt-sleeved saloon clerk, a fop in his own right since the shirt was a ruffled one of finest linen and lace. The colored decanters, among which a Dutch clock quaintly ticked, were like an iris sparkling behind his shoulders, like an aureole surrounding his perfumed head. From glass to glass the ice and the wine and the Monongahela passed. An odor of musk, absinthe, and lemon peel filled the saloon. The glare of its camphene lamps brought out the dark asterisks produced on the white sand of its floor by expectoration. In another year of our Lord, namely 1941, I caught some very good moths at the neon lights of a gasoline station between Dallas and Fort Worth. Into the bar comes the villain, the slave-whipping Mississippian, ex-captain of volunteers, handsome, swaggering, scowling Cassius Calhoun. After toasting America for Americans and confusion to all foreign interlopers, especially the D-D, an evasion that puzzled me sorely when I first stumbled upon it, dead, detested, Irish, he intentionally collided with Maurice the Mustanger, scarlet scarf, slashed velvet trousers, hot Irish blood. A young horse trader who was really a baronet, Sir Maurice Gerald, as his thrilled bride was to discover at the end of the book. Wrong thrills like this may have been one of the reasons that the Irish-born author's fame waned so soon in his adopted country. Immediately after the collision, Maurice performed several actions in the following order. He deposited his glass upon the counter, drew a silk handkerchief from his pocket, wiped from his embroidered shirt bosom the defilement of the whiskey, transferred the handkerchief from his right hand to his left, took the half-empty glass from the counter, swilled its remaining contents into Calhoun's face, quietly redeposited the glass upon the counter. This sequence I still know by heart, so often did my cousin and I enact it. The duel took place there and then, in the emptied barroom, the men using Colt's six-shooters. Despite my interest in the fight, both were wounded, their blood spurted all over the sanded floor. I could not prevent myself from leaving the saloon in my fancy to mingle with the hushed crowd in front of the hotel, so as to make out, in the scented dark, certain señoritas of questionable calling. With still more excitement did I read of Louise Poindexter, Calhoun's fair cousin, daughter of a sugar planter, the highest and haughtiest of his class, though why an old man who planted sugar should be high and haughty was a mystery to me. She is revealed in the throes of jealousy, which I used to feel so keenly at miserable parties when Mara Rzewuski, a pale child with a white silk bow in her black hair, suddenly and inexplicably stopped noticing me, standing upon the edge of her azotea, her white hand resting upon the copestone of the parapet, which is still wet with the dews of night, her twin breasts sinking and swelling in quick spasmodic breathing, her twin breasts, let me reread, sinking and swelling, her lorgnette directed. That lorgnette I found afterward in the hands of Madame Bovary, and later Anna Karenin had it, and then it passed into the possession of Chekhov's lady with the lapdog, and was lost by her on the pier at Yalta. When Louise held it, it was directed toward the speckled shadows under the mesquites, where the horseman of her choice was having an innocent conversation with the daughter of a wealthy haciendado, Doña Isidora Covarrubio de los Llanos, whose head of hair in luxuriance rivaled the tail of a wild steed. I had the opportunity, Maurice later explained to Louise as one rider to another, of being useful to Doña Isidora in once rescuing her from some rude Indians. A slight service, you call it, the young Creole exclaimed. A man who should do that much for me. What would you do for him? Asked Maurice eagerly. Pardieu, I should love him. Then I would give half my life to see you in the hands of Wildcat and his drunken comrades, and the other half to deliver you from the danger. And here we find the gallant author interpolating a strange confession. The sweetest kiss that I ever had in my life was when a woman, a fair creature in the hunting field, leant over in her saddle and kissed me as I sate in mine. The sate, let us concede, gives duration and body to the kiss which the captain so comfortably had, but I could not help feeling, even at the age of 11, that centaurian lovemaking was not without its special limitations. Moreover, Yuri and I both knew a boy who had tried it, but the girl's horse had pushed his into a ditch. Exhausted by our adventures in the chaparral, we lay on the grass and discussed women. Our innocence seems to me now almost monstrous in the light of various sexual confessions to be found in Havelock Ellis and elsewhere, which involve tiny tots mating like mad. The slums of sex were unknown to us. Had we ever happened to hear about two normal lads idiotically masturbating in each other's presence, as described so sympathetically with all the smells in modern American novels, the mere notion of such an act would have seemed to us as comic and impossible as sleeping with an amylus. Our ideal was Queen Guinevere, Isolde, a not quite merciless belle dame, another man's wife, proud and docile, fashionable and fast, with slim ankles and narrow hands. The little girls in neat socks and pumps whom we and other boys used to meet at dancing lessons or at Christmas tree parties had all the enchantments, all the sweets and stars of the tree preserved in their flame-dotted iris, and they teased us. They glanced back. They delightfully participated in our vaguely festive dreams. But they belonged, those nymphets, to another class of creatures than the adolescent belles and large-hatted vamps for whom we actually yearned. After having made me sign an oath of secrecy with blood, Yuri told me about the married lady in Warsaw, with whom at 12 or 13 he was secretly in love, and whom a couple of years later he made love to. By comparison, it would have sounded jejun, I feared, to tell him about my seaside playmates, but I cannot recall what substitute I invented to match his romance. Around that time, though, a real romantic adventure did come my way. I am now going to do something quite difficult, a kind of double somersault with a Welsh waggle. Old acrobats will know what I mean. And I want complete silence, please. 3. In August 1910, my brother and I were in Bad Kissingen with our parents and tutor, Lenski. After that, my father and mother traveled to Munich and Paris, and back to St. Petersburg, and then to Berlin, where we boys, with Lenski, were spending the autumn and the beginning of the winter, having our teeth fixed. An American dentist, Lowell or Lowen, I do not remember his name exactly, ripped some of our teeth out and trussed up others with twine before disfiguring us with braces. Even more hellish than the action of the rubber pair pumping hot pain into a cavity were the cotton pads. I could not endure their dry contact and squeak, which used to be thrust between gum and tongue for the operator's convenience. And there would be, in the window pane before one's helpless eyes, a transparency, some dismal seascape or gray grapes, shuddering with the dull reverberations of distant trams under dull skies. In den Zelten 18a. The address comes back to me, dancing trochaically, immediately followed by the whispery motion of the cream-colored electric taxi that took us there. We expected every possible compensation and atonement for those dreadful mornings. My brother loved the museum of wax figures in the arcade off the Unter den Linden. Friedrich's Grenadiers, Bonaparte communing with a mummy, young Liszt, who composed a rhapsody in his sleep, and Marat, who died in a shoe. And for me, who did not know yet that Marat had been an ardent lepidopterist, there was, at the corner of that arcade, Gruber's famous butterfly shop, a camphoraceous paradise at the top of a steep, narrow staircase, which I climbed every other day to inquire if Chapman's new hair streak or Mann's recently rediscovered white had been obtained for me at last. We tried tennis on a public court, but a wintry gale kept chasing dead leaves across it, and besides, Lenski could not really play, although insisting on joining us without removing his overcoat in a lopsided threesome. Subsequently, most of our afternoons were spent at a roller skating rink in the Kurfürstendamm. I remember Lenski rolling inexorably toward a pillar which he attempted to embrace while collapsing with a dreadful clatter. And after persevering a while, he would content himself with sitting in one of the loges that flanked the plush parapet, and consuming there wedges of slightly salty mocha torte with whipped cream, while I kept self-sufficiently overtaking poor, gamely, stumbling Sergei, one of those galling little pictures that revolve on and on in one's mind. A military band, Germany at the time was the land of music, manned by an uncommonly jerky conductor, came to life every 10 minutes or so, but could hardly drown the ceaseless, sweeping rumble of wheels. There existed in Russia, and still exists, no doubt, a special type of school-age boy who, without necessarily being athletic in appearance or outstanding in mental scope, often having, in fact, no energy in class, a rather scrawny physique and even perhaps a touch of pulmonary consumption, excels quite phenomenally at soccer and chess, and learns with the utmost ease and grace any kind of sport or game of skill. Borya Shik, Kostya Bugatov, the famous brothers Sharabanov, where are they now, my teammates and rivals? I was a good skater on ice, and switching to rollers was for me not more difficult than for a man to replace an ordinary razor by a safety one. Very quickly I learned two or three tricky steps on the wooden floor of the rink, and in no ballroom have I danced with more zest or ability. We, Sheiks and Bugatovs, are poor ballroom dancers as a rule. The several instructors wore scarlet uniforms, half hussar and half hotel page. They all spoke English, of one brand or another. Among the regular visitors, I soon noticed a group of American young ladies. At first, they all merged in a common spin of bright, exotic beauty. The process of differentiation began when, during one of my lone dances, and a few seconds before I came the worst cropper that I ever came on a rink, somebody said something about me as I whirled by, and a wonderful, twangy, feminine voice answered, "Yes, isn't he cunning?" I can still see her tall figure in a navy blue tailor-made suit. Her large velvet hat was transfixed by a dazzling pin. For obvious reasons, I decided her name was Louise. At night I would lie awake and imagine all kinds of romantic situations, and think of her willowy waist and white throat, and worry over an odd discomfort that I had associated before only with chafing shorts. One afternoon I saw her standing in the lobby of the rink, and the most dashing of the instructors, a sleek ruffian of the Calhoun type, was holding her by the wrist and interrogating her with a crooked grin, and she was looking away and childishly turning her wrist this way and that in his grasp. And the following night he was shot, lassoed, buried alive, shot again, throttled, bitingly insulted, coolly aimed at, spared, and left to drag a life of shame. High-principled, but rather simple, Lenski, who was abroad for the first time, had some trouble keeping the delights of sightseeing in harmony with his pedagogical duties. We took advantage of this and guided him toward places where our parents might not have allowed us to go. He could not resist the Wintergarten, for instance, and so one night we found ourselves there, drinking iced chocolate in an orchestra box. The show developed on the usual lines. A juggler in evening clothes, then a woman with flashes of rhinestones on her bosom trilling a concert aria in alternating effusions of green and red light, then a comic on roller skates. Between him and the bicycle act, of which more later, there was an item on the program called the Gala Girls, and with something of the shattering and ignominious physical shock I had experienced when coming that cropper on the rink, I recognized my American ladies in the garland of linked, shrill-voiced, shameless girls, all rippling from left to right and then from right to left with a rhythmic rising of 10 identical legs that shot up from 10 corollas of flounces. I located my Louise's face and knew at once that it was all over, that I had lost her, that I would never forgive her for singing so loudly, for smiling so redly, for disguising herself in that ridiculous way so unlike the charm of either proud Creoles or questionable señoritas. I could not stop thinking of her altogether, of course, but the shock seems to have liberated in me a certain inductive process, for I soon noticed that any evocation of the feminine form would be accompanied by the puzzling discomfort already familiar to me. I asked my parents about it. They had come to Berlin to see how we were getting along. And my father ruffled the German newspaper he had just opened and replied in English, with a parody of a possible quotation, a manner of speech he often adopted in order to get going. "That, my boy, is just another of nature's absurd combinations, like shame and blushes, or grief and red eyes." "Tolstoy vient de mourir," he suddenly added, in another stunned voice, turning to my mother. "Dach toti, Something like, "Good gracious," she exclaimed in distress, clasping her hands in her lap. "Pora domoy," time to go home, she concluded, as if Tolstoy's death had been the portent of apocalyptic disasters. 4. And now comes the bicycle act, or at least my version of it. The following summer, Yuri did not visit us at Vera, and I was left alone to cope with my romantic agitation. On rainy days, crouching at the foot of a little-used bookshelf, in a poor light that did all it could to discourage my furtive inquiry, I used to look up obscurely tantalizing and enervating terms in the Russian 82-volume edition of Brockhaus's Encyclopedia, where, in order to save space, the title word of this or that article would be reduced throughout a detailed discussion to its capitalized initial, so that the columns of dense print in minion type, besides taxing one's attention, acquired the trumpery fascination of a masquerade, at which the abbreviation of a none-too-familiar word played hide-and-seek with one's avid eyes. Moses tried to abolish P, but failed. In modern times, hospitable P flourished in Austria under Maria Theresa. In many parts of Germany, the profits from P went to the clergy. In Russia, P has been officially tolerated since 1843. Seduced at the age of 10 or 12 by her master, his sons or one of his menials, an orphan almost invariably ends in P. And so forth, all of which went to enrich with mystery, rather than soberly elucidate, the allusions to meretricious love that I met with during my first immersions in Chekhov or Andreev. Butterfly hunting and various sports took care of the sunny hours, but no amount of exercise could prevent the restlessness which every evening launched me on vague voyages of discovery. After riding on horseback most of the afternoon, bicycling in the colored dusk was a curiously subtle, almost discarnate feeling. I had turned upside down and lowered to sub-saddle level the handlebars of my Enfield bicycle, converting it into my conception of a racing model. Along the paths of the park I would skim, following yesterday's patterned imprint of Dunlop tires, neatly avoiding the ridges of tree roots, selecting a fallen twig and snapping it with my sensitive front wheel, weaving between two flat leaves, and then between a small stone and the hole from which it had been dislodged the evening before, enjoying the brief smoothness of a bridge over a brook, skirting the wire fence of the tennis court, nuzzling open the little whitewashed gate at the end of the park, and then, in a melancholy ecstasy of freedom, speeding along the hard-baked, pleasantly agglutinate margins of long country roads. That summer I would always ride by a certain izba, golden in the low sun, in the doorway of which Polenka, the daughter of our head coachman Zahar, a girl of my age, would stand leaning against the jamb, her bare arms folded on her breast in a soft, comfortable manner peculiar to rural Russia. She would watch me approach with a wonderful, welcoming radiance on her face, but as I rode nearer, this would dwindle to a half-smile, then to a faint light at the corners of her compressed lips, and finally this too would fade, so that when I reached her, there would be no expression at all on her round, pretty face. As soon as I had passed, however, and had turned my head for an instant to take a last look before sprinting uphill, the dimple would be back. The enigmatic light would be playing again on her dear features. I never spoke to her, but long after I had stopped riding by at that hour, our ocular relationship was renewed from time to time during 2 or 3 summers. She would appear from nowhere, always standing a little apart, always barefoot, rubbing her left instep against her right calf, or scratching with her fourth finger the parting in her light brown hair, and always leaning against things, against the stable door while my horse was being saddled, against the trunk of a tree when the whole array of country servitors would be seeing us off to town for the winter on a crisp September morning. Every time, her bosom seemed a little softer, her forearms a little stronger, and once or twice I discerned, just before she drifted out of my ken, at 16 she married a blacksmith in a distant village, a gleam of gentle mockery in her wide-set hazel eyes.